Next case on the calendar for oral argument is State of Minnesota versus Robert Richardson. While you are getting settled, I'll remind you each that you have 15 minutes to make your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal as well. The timing will be indicated in the lights at the podium. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. And when you're settled and ready to go, counsel for appellant, we are ready for your argument.
Good morning, counsel, ladies and gentlemen in the audience. May it please the court. My name is Kirk Anderson, and I represent the appellant, Robert Richardson, in this matter. Your Honor, I believe that this matter was fully briefed, but there are a couple of points that I would like to highlight. First of all, I am in agreement with the state that the sole issue in this trial was whether or not Mr. Richardson acted in self-defense. Everything else was not in dispute. The state's argument essentially, and recall that the burden does shift to the state to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Mr. Richardson did not act in self-defense. And the state's response of stating that he did not was really twofold. One, that he had a duty to retreat, and two, that he did not act or did not use reasonable force. With regards to the duty to retreat, in this situation, I think you have to look at the totality of the circumstances, of course. It's late.
So we've had a lot of cases recently where the incorrect self-defense jury instruction has been given, but that's not the case here. So the jury was correctly instructed as to what the self-defense defense was.
I believe they were, Your Honor. I didn't notice any issues with that. The court actually during the trial was going back and forth on whether they were going to instruct the self-defense or not, and ultimately did do so. But I didn't notice anything improper about what the defense itself was.
Thank you.
So with regards to the duty to flee, again, in this case, Mr. Richardson was not the aggressor, that's clear. Mr. Richardson came from a long day of work, was trying to get on the light rail train, and encountered these two individuals, both of whom apparently had been consuming significant amounts of alcohol throughout the day, although how drunk they really were is kind of not clearly known, but from some testimony it was that they were pretty intoxicated.
Well, and you can see him staggering on the platform.
Correct, yes, Your Honor. And I believe the doctor that treated Mr. Barros, his opinion was that he was incredibly drunk. And frankly, when you're as injured as he was and in a hospital room and trying to get up and frankly not feeling any pain, must have been, you know, had quite a few before this happened. Mr. Richardson was encountered. He was hit from behind. The fight was not.
Can we back up?
Sure.
I mean, you said, I think you just said Mr. Barros was the aggressor. How or at what point in time was he the aggressor?
Sure, Your Honor. Well, initially there was an encounter.
And I think you could assume that we've all seen the video, and so we know that sequence, you know, from visually seeing it.
Sure. Initially, obviously, there was not a exchange of blows, but there was some verbal altercation back and forth. Mr. Richardson exited or attempted to walk away, but realized he needed to go back.
Realized he needed to go back. Can you elaborate on that? Why
sure,
did he need to go back?
He needed to go back to his testimony was that he needed to get a ticket to get back on the train. He was not familiar with this platform. He did not know where the ticket was. Unfortunately for him, he had actually walked past the ticket booth the first time and missed. Unfortunately, I didn't encounter these individuals again. But he did not go back to try to re-engage these individuals.
However, that was his testimony.
Yes.
But he gave a statement shortly after saying something different, right?
I think what his statement initially was is that they continued to speak with him, but his testimony at trial was that they continued to yell at him and say, you know, offensive things to him. But
the statement to the officer given after the event, that was in evidence at trial, right?
I believe the officer did testify or did play his interview, yes.
And what did he say about that point, that about why Richardson turned around?
Why did he return?
What did the officer testify that Richardson said about why Richardson turned around to walk back toward the other two men?
I don't recall verbatim. I believe he did, in fact, he said that I did need to go back to get the ticket, but he did say something in regards to they continued to talk to me or say things to me, and he was offended by that. He was upset, but he did not say even in that statement that he went back to engage or to confront those individuals. I don't recall him saying that in the statement or his testimony.
I mean, if a jury found that not credible And if the jury thought that he turned around because he wanted to initiate a physical confrontation, I mean, that would be enough for the state to disprove the self-defense defense, right?
I guess that's a possibility, Your Honor. I don't think there was any indication that Mr. Richardson went back to actually engage in some sort of physical altercation with them. I believe that the testimony from any statements or anybody that was produced at trial was that Mr. Barros did actually start this fight. He's the one that first threw the first punch. That's where it came from. So
if it's a duty to retreat, I mean, he already was retreating. He was walking away. Richardson was walking away from the two. He could have continued walking.
That's true, Your Honor. I agree. But when he does go back, remember, he does not go back and institute a physical fight. If anything, it might be a verbal fight at that point. But once, you know, fisticuffs come on to play, then things are a little different. In that context, once he's starting to get hit, there's two individuals there. Mr. Richardson essentially is under the impression that he's being attacked by two people. And his testimony is clear. He's standing right next to a light rail line. He's concerned. There's a train coming. They could try to grab him and throw him onto in front of the train. He was very concerned. At that point, he was not the aggressor. Mr. Barros, they're the ones that started this fight, the actual physical altercation. I think that there's a difference between a verbal altercation and whether he went back to say, hey, knock it off, be quiet, blah, blah, blah. But once it became physical, that was not Mr. Richardson that started that fight. And once the physical altercation started, he needs to defend himself. So I think that he really, in that context, did not have a duty to retreat. The issue that the state, I think, mainly is arguing is that his response was not reasonable under the circumstances. I think my assumption is that the basis is that just because of how severe of the injuries were and the fact that a knife came out. But again,
multiple slashing injuries.
Correct.
I mean, that's not, how is that reasonable? Wouldn't one be enough? Doesn't more than one suggest lack of reasonable?
Well, that's all in the eye of the beholder, Your Honor, and I think that that's where you have to look at under the circumstances, where this, again, late at night, intoxicated individuals being attacked by two people on a light rail platform where he's concerned he might be getting thrown onto a train.
Part of the issue is that all of that, in my estimation, tell me where I'm wrong, is that all of that was thoroughly argued to the jury. The jury was properly instructed on self-defense, and they found against your client.
Your Honor, that is exactly what happened. And I think that kind of leads into my next point as well, is when it comes to the jury instructions and the additional instructions that they did give to the jury. Again, it's not disputed that the jury came back. Obviously, the jury was having issues with the self-defense. That was the only issue, and they came back three times and said, haven't come to a decision, and twice saying we're deadlocked.
Well, having been a district court judge, it's not ever clear what hangs a jury up. I mean, you just don't know.
Very true. But again, Your Honor, that was the only issue for trial. I mean, in reality, that was the only issue, was self-defense. If the self-defense claim was not there, there was no dispute that Mr. Richardson was the individual that caused the cuts. There was no dispute that the cuts raised to the level of a first-degree assault. The issue was self-defense. So that, in reality, is what the jury was probably fighting over.
This jury didn't deliberate all that long. I mean, as I recall, they deliberated an hour or so on the first day, a full day on Friday, and then reached their verdict on the following Monday morning.
And then into Monday, that's correct, Your Honor. And the timing issue, there really is no set standard as to what is a proper amount of time. Could it be 15 minutes? Could it be 15 hours? You never really know. But when the jury and their initial letter back to the court is that we're at a deadlock, the judge gives the additional instruction, again, that she had not given to them previously before the jury began to deliberate. And the state argues that this should be reviewed on a plain error because it was not objected to. It was objected to. Perhaps counsel did not say specifically or it was not clear, but he did tell the judge, I think this is improper. I don't think you should give this additional instruction. And initially, the court wanted to give even more of the Florida jury instruction, but she eventually changed her mind and took out some of it. But in reality, what the instruction does is it tells the jury, you need to keep deliberating until you come to a decision. Now, they read the instruction, they go back and deliberate for a few more hours and come back and say, we are still deadlocked. Plus, we need to get out of here for work, we need to go to school. And the judge says, sorry, you go home, you're coming back on Monday. At that point, the jury is reasonable to conclude that we have to come up with a unanimous verdict or we're not going home ever. And that is what the Bugs case talks about, is that if the jury's believes that it's required to deliberate until it comes to a unanimous verdict and it has no other options, then that is an abuse of discretion. That's improper.
What is it about the language of the instruction the district court gave that tells them you have to stay forever until you have a unanimous verdict?
I don't think, Your Honor, I'm not saying specifically that's what it says, but this is what it states. First, there's two things that a jury can lawfully do: agree on a verdict or disagree on what the facts of the case may be. A jury obviously can disagree on whether an individual is guilty or not guilty, and if they can't come to an unanimous verdict, there is not a decision. There's a mistrial.
But then she says, and so I'm going to send you back to continue discussing this case, and I want to remind you, you should discuss this case with one another and deliberate with a view toward reaching agreement, if you can do so without violating your individual judgment. You should decide the case for yourself, but only after you've discussed the case with your fellow jurors and carefully considered the views. You should not hesitate to re-examine your views, change your opinion, if you become convinced they are erroneous. But you should not surrender your honest opinions simply because other jurors disagree or merely to reach a verdict, which to me is not saying you have to reach a unanimous verdict.
She didn't say specifically you have to reach a unanimous verdict, but I think that by giving this additional instruction, which was not given before the initial jury instructions, I think the court had good intentions in hoping to get them to continue to deliberate, but when they come back again a few hours later and say, we're still deadlocked, we're not coming up with a different decision, and she says at that point, you still need to come back on Monday, you need to come back, you need to keep deliberating, at that point the jury is thinking, we need to come up with a verdict here or we're not going home ever. How are we possibly going to, if we can't agree, we can't agree. What are we supposed to do? And they come back on Monday and verdict, guilty, self-defense doesn't claim. So obviously they were really grappling with that self-defense issue. And I think that the additional jury instructions, it was an abuse of discretion. I think it did prejudice Mr. Richardson. We don't want to trample on, make the jury feel that they're being forced to come up with a decision. That's clearly not what we should be doing in these kind of cases.
I just want to also clarify your argument, because trial counsel said this is not an Allen instruction. And so what are you saying on appeal?
So, Your Honor, I wasn't there. My assumption is that the court came up with this and he was not fully expecting it. He says, I don't agree that this is an Allen charge, but in further research, it essentially is. I mean, it's the Florida Allen charge, and that's pretty much what the court read. So yes, at trial, he said, I don't think it's an Allen charge, but in reality, I do believe that it is. But he still did object to it being read. So he may have not spoken properly, but he did object to it. So. And then as far as any final points, Your Honor, I'm running out of time. Just specifically with regards to the alcohol issue, that I'm not going to say that in and of itself is rendering of a new trial, obviously. But I think when you take a look at the other issues that I also raised, and then the fact of Mr. Barrow's testimony saying, I didn't feel tipsy, that raises an impeachment question. And when he's giving testimony saying, I'm not drunk, and there's actually physical blood evidence showing that he is, that's information that should be addressed for impeachment purposes. And when you look at that on its own, I'm not going to say that would be the basis for a new trial, but when you take that into context of the self-defense claim, obviously credibility was a huge issue. And then you also look at the jury instruction issue. I think that raises an issue that Mr. Richardson did not get a fair trial, and he should be remanded for further proceedings.
Doesn't that credibility issue, to the extent that was already there when you have the video evidence of how Mr. Barrows looked prior to the assault, when you have the doctor's testimony about his extreme intoxication, then the jury heard his testimony, I wasn't feeling tipsy. I mean, the ability to impeach was already there, wasn't it?
I think the ability to impeach is there, but I think it's different when you can specifically show this is how much alcohol he really had in his system. I think that's a lot more powerful than just a doctor saying he appeared to be incredibly intoxicated. Maybe he is, maybe he isn't. Nobody really knows. It's all in the eyes of the beholder. But when you have a physical document stating this is what was in his system, that's very powerful.
Well, how would the jury understand that measurement?
That, Your Honor, the court, when she denied it, just said because it's in a different measurement than, say, a DWI is, that's something that the doctor could have easily described as to what it is, or if they would have called in another witness to say this is the mathematical equivalence of what 0.24 grams per deciliter is compared to 0.08 milliliters for DWIs. It could have been very easily figured out. It's not a complicated...
Well, how does it compare? Do you know, as a matter of fact, is it just moving a decimal?
No, Your Honor. I believe my recollection is, and I'm not a mathematician, I'm certainly not a forensic scientist, is that one deciliter is essentially equivalent to 100 milliliters. So 0.24 grams is very similar to what a 0.24 per milliliter would be. So it's my understanding is it's approximately three times the legal limit to drive. So it's a pretty high amount. But again, it wasn't that they weren't really able to get into that. But I just, from doing some independent kind of research, that appeared to be what around the equivalency would be.
I mean, and so did you make a proffer that you were planning to tell the jury how to interpret the evidence and put it into context and compare it to something else? I mean, because if you would have just had the number in by itself, what would that have told the jury other than perhaps something that they might have made an incorrect assumption about what it means?
Sure, and I'm out of time. May I answer your question?
Please.
It didn't get that far. They raised the motion to the court, and the judge denied it. It didn't get to a proffer ability. And I think, obviously, if they were to just say, here's the piece of paper, there would have had to have been a proffer, some foundation laid as to what that would have been. But it didn't get to that point because the judges didn't allow it.
It sounds like, if I may, it sounds like, going back to what you said earlier, this claimed error alone is you're agreeing it's not prejudicial enough to give you a new trial, but only in combination. So you're essentially arguing cumulative.
Yes. This single issue alone is, I think, the court's not going to give them a fair trial on that. But
and you're not asking us to.
But you can if you'd like. Okay. Thank you.
All right, you will have time for rebuttal. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Raggetts. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I represent respondent state of Minnesota in this matter. This morning, I intend to address three of appellant's four issues, the sufficiency, the deadlock jury, and the blood alcohol evidence, but I'll leave the sentencing issue for my brief unless this court has questions on it. Starting with sufficiency, a key point here is that it doesn't matter what appellant testified to at trial. The standard of review for you is you must presume the jury didn't believe his testimony, and you must look at the evidence in the light most favorable to the state. And in doing so, the key fact here is that appellant admitted that he retreated but then went back because of words that were said. And that's on Exhibit 28A, page 7. To follow up on the questions from Judge Johnson, the officer said, "What made you walk back toward him?" And appellant said, the words that were being said, quote, punk pussy, unquote, or something like that. He never said anything about, well, I had to go back there to get a ticket, and I'm not sure there's a necessity to defense to failure to retreat anyway, and I'm not sure that not wanting to wait for the next train would be a necessity in the first place. But the key point here is he admitted he retreated, but then he went back voluntarily. That alone is enough to defeat self-defense. He was not forced to go back. There had already been a confrontation. He could have stayed away from it, but you've seen the video. He voluntarily walks back and re-engages, and that defeats self-defense.
Now, so let's say that what you say is all true and we accept that. Is there still an argument that, you know, there's another duty to retreat at, that we still evaluate it, you know, after the parties, people have engaged? I mean, that's what Mr. Anderson is arguing, that we have to look at it as of the point in time when Mr. Barros threw the first punch.
I think that would make the duty to retreat meaningless if you could retreat but then voluntarily get back in the mix. And it's not like he just had a pleasant exchange with these guys and walked back toward him. There had already been a confrontation. He knew these guys were really drunk and were being really obnoxious, frankly, and he walks away, but then he goes back because of the words. That's what he said. So he's not going back to get a ticket. He's going back because these guys are jabbing at him, and he gets into it with them. So he voluntarily engages in this confrontation, and that's alone enough to defeat self-defense because he did retreat, and he could have continued to retreat. He didn't have to undo his retreat, essentially. Now, you also have the fact here that he didn't use reasonable force because, again, we don't have just one slash to the face or to the wrist or something. We don't have just displaying a razor blade and saying, don't mess with me. We have these gruesome multiple permanent injuries. So that also defeats self-defense. But the failure to retreat is really what's key here. You can see it on the video. So, again, it doesn't matter what appellant testified to. And the video shows this wasn't a two-against-one situation where you have two guys wailing on him and he has no choice but to grab his razor blade. The video shows, as the officer testified, that he actually grabbed the razor blade from his hat before he even got back to get into it with these guys. So he already had the razor blade. He says at trial it's just there because of work. He says in his statement he has it there for protection. So the video speaks for itself and shows he didn't retreat and he didn't have to do the horrible things he did here.
Does the video show that he has the razor in his hand before?
The video shows he's got something in his hand, and that was the argument. It's a reasonable inference when he takes something out of his hat and he goes back and he's got something in his hand that that's what it is. The jurors may well have believed that. The video doesn't clearly show it is a razor in his hand, but shortly thereafter he has a razor in his hand that he's using it on the victim's face. So it's a very reasonable inference. This would be a slightly more challenging case if we didn't have the failure to retreat issue. I grant that. But the failure to retreat alone defeats the claim. And the evidence under the video that the jurors saw is clearly sufficient to defeat the self-defense claim. So I'll move on to the deadlocked jury, since appellant now seems to be making a cumulative effects argument with that and the blood alcohol content evidence, which isn't in the brief. The key fact here is that the jurors were never told you have to reach a verdict. To the contrary, and I think this is extremely important, it's on pages 8 and 9 of the volume 4 of the transcript. Judge Starr explicitly told the jurors, quote, it's legally permissible for a jury to disagree, unquote. So the jurors were never under an impression that you have to reach a verdict whether it takes you all month. That's just simply not the case. And the jurors hadn't deliberated very long. So the other issue, per the case law in my brief, is were the jurors made to deliberate for an unreasonable length of time? Well, here it was about a day, and it had been a 3-day trial. And then they come back after having had the weekend to think about it. They reach a verdict on Monday. Appellants seem to suggest that they just reached a verdict first thing Monday because they wanted to go home. We don't know that from the transcript. The verdict could have been 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Monday after they thoroughly discussed things again. We don't know from the transcript when on Monday, but it wasn't that long. And there was never any suggestion to the jurors that come back Monday and we're going to be here through Friday until you reach a verdict. There was nothing like that. There was no reason for the jurors to think that if they told the judge again on Monday, look, we've thought about it, we've talked about it, we just can't reach a verdict, that the judge was going to say, come back Tuesday or come back Wednesday. There's nothing that hints at that here. And the jury instructions certainly don't hint at that. And defense counsel below was correct when he conceded that this was not an Allen charge. If you look at the Martin case,
there's no question that defense counsel objected to it. So to suggest that, I'm not certain that plain error governed. I mean, you can make a slightly different argument about something without having, you know, without saying you're raising something for the first time on a
Well,
video.
I think it's important to look at how it unfolded here, because when Judge Starr said she was going to give an instruction to the jurors, the defense quibbled with some of it. And so Judge Starr then changed it. And then when she gave the instruction, the defense never said, nope, we still need this language out, or here's the language you should use. The defense just said, generally, we object. So the defense didn't preserve any particular objection because the defense never said, here's the language I find problematic, or here's what you should be telling the jurors that you're not telling the jurors. And it is important here that, contrary to appellant's brief, the defense never said, we think there should be a mistrial. So the argument has to be Judge Starr plainly erred by not sua sponte declaring a mistrial. She didn't. There's no case law that supports that. And even today, I haven't heard what specifically Judge Starr said that she shouldn't have said, or what Judge Starr didn't say that trial judges typically do say or should say. The notion here is just, well, the jurors shouldn't have been forced to keep deliberating. But again, the defense never asked for a mistrial. This hadn't gone on very long, and the jurors were explicitly told, don't surrender your honest opinions. You don't need to reach a verdict. But it's not wrong, as the case law says, to force a jury to keep trying for a little bit, to not let them give up too soon. And here, with a three-day trial and less than a day of deliberations, it would have been too soon.
What are the arguments I hear and read in the brief and hear again this morning is not only is this addition of this Florida language problematic, but the fact that the district court hadn't given that language before the jury began their deliberations, but gave it during the midst of trial for the first time. How do you respond to that argument?
I don't think appellant has argued in the briefs, at least, that the language is okay. It was just the timing of the language was bad because it should have been initially.
They argue both points, and I'm wondering what your response is to the argument that it's wrong because the language was not given before they began deliberating.
I don't know of any case law that supports that. I don't know of any case law that says if you have a deadlocked jury, you just have to let them go. You just have to let them quit unless you've earlier given the language that you want to give again later. I mean, I think it all comes down to, under the case law, is a jury improperly pressured to reach a verdict? And under Allen charges, that happens by telling the minority you should reconsider your views, or by telling the jury, if you don't reach a verdict, it's just going to go to some other jury eventually. There's various ways that Martin described Allen charges as putting pressure on juries. None of those happened here. And again, appellant has still never specified what it is that Judge Starr said that was so wrong here that it led the jurors to believe they had to reach a verdict. And again, she told them, you don't have to reach a verdict. It's legally permissible not to reach a verdict. She just forced them to think about it a little longer over the weekend, come back, and then they reached a verdict. So where you have no specific objection, where you have no request for a mistrial, where you don't have any of the problematic Allen charge language, it's very hard for me to see how Judge Starr committed error or plain error here, such that appellant is entitled to a new trial. On the blood alcohol content issue, there's three reasons that this does not entitle appellant to a new trial cumulatively or on its own. First, there is no dispute at trial that the victim was very drunk. Indeed, the doctor described him as, quote, incredibly drunk, unquote. So there's no dispute, and even if, no matter how drunk the victim was, it doesn't excuse appellant's failure to retreat, which is on video, or his use of unreasonable force. So the probative value, the relevance, is very low. And third, what happened here is on video. The jurors could see for themselves how the victim could barely stand up. The jurors could see for themselves what happened. So the credibility of just how drunk the victim was wasn't really relevant. The victim did say he'd been drinking vodka all day. Ultimately, the other problem with this evidence is it is confusing. Judge Starr told the parties, I'm not going to let this in because it's deciliters and the 0.08 legal limit is milliliters. And the defense never said, oh, we can clear that up. Here's who we'd ask a question about that of. Here's the expert we would call who could explain how this translates. The defense had every opportunity to make an offer of proof that they could clear up this confusion, but never did. I also am not a mathematician, but I did put in online yesterday, how do you convert deciliters to milliliters? And I think there must be a mistake in this number, because if you do that online, 0.24 deciliters, according to an online translator, is 0.0024 milliliters. So it's a fraction of the legal limit. Now, that can't be right given the description here, but that just shows how confusing this would have been for the jury to try and figure out. I mean, deciliters and milliliters are obviously not the same thing. That's not how the metric system works. So how the jurors would have dealt with this information, we don't know. It could have been very confusing. But bottom line is, there's no dispute the victim was drunk. The jurors saw what happened on the video. And no matter how drunk somebody is, you still have a duty to retreat. And you still have a duty to not use unreasonable force, like happened here. Appellant's now making a cumulative effects argument. I think that's been waived by not being briefed. There can't be any cumulative effect with sufficiency, so it would just be a cumulative effect with the jury instructions. But again, there wasn't any problem with the jury instructions here. Judge Starr properly told the jurors they didn't have to reach a verdict, but just made them keep trying for a little longer after a three-day trial. And self-defense is hard. I mean, the jurors were no doubt struggling with the duty to retreat, the amount of force that was reasonable. We have a very unsympathetic victim here, I grant you that, and that also was probably difficult for the jury. But this isn't a case where you had 2 hours of testimony and then 2 days of deliberation. This was a case with lots of witnesses, over 3 days and forcing the jurors to think about it for a day or so is not unreasonable under any case law that I've ever seen. And as I said, I'll leave the sentencing issue to my brief unless this court has questions on it or on any of the other issues. I will simply ask that you affirm the conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Anderson, you will have the last word.
I'll be very brief. I just wanted to, in regards to whether or not the defense did object, the defense did object initially before the additional instructions, and when the judge said, well, I'm going to change the language around a little bit, he still said, I don't think you should read this at all. I think you should just leave the jig as it is, CRIMJIG 3.04. And again, I'll say this just to clarify what the counsel said. From State v. Martin, if the jury is deadlocked, CRIMJIG 3.0 may be read to them, but only if it was given in the original charge. None of the additional Florida language was in the original charge. It was all added after the fact. That was where the court abused its discretion under that context. Again, I agree with counsel. Everything else is briefed fully if you have any other questions.
So sometimes the CRIMJIG, CRIMJIG is not law, of course. So you're not aware of case law that says what the CRIMJIG says? Does my question make sense? I'm sorry if I...
Not really, but I think I know where you're going with this. I think the difference, Your Honor, is if the court would have on the front end added this language, and because that happens frequently where district court judges will change the jigs around a little bit for a specific case, but in this case, I believe it was read verbatim out of the jury instructions book, and then she changed it after the fact once the jury came back deadlocked the first time. So that's the difference. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel, thank you both for your arguments today. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day period. That is the last case on our calendar for oral argument, and so we are in recess.